And welcome to Writers on Writing on 88.9 KUCI FM. We're broadcasting from the University of California, Irvine campus. We stream live at kuci.org. You can always find us on iTunes. Find our podcast on iTunes. Today's Wednesday, October 9th, 2019. I'm Barbara DeMarco Barrett, and my guest today for the entire hour is poet Grant Heyer. Hey, he's in the studio. Hello.
Hello. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, I'm going to do a bio.
Okay.
And I'm not sure I hear you on your mic. Wrong mic. There he is. Okay.
Can you hear me now?
Now I can. Anyway, this is a much abbreviated bio of Grant. He has the longest bio of anyone I know. it's true.
I need an editor.
Grant is the inaugural poet laureate of the city of Anaheim. He's the author of the book-length poem Unintended Garden, Histories and Reinhabitation in Suburbia, and two poetry collections released in 2018 by Pelicanesis, The Difference Between and Similitude. He co-wrote a book of historical flash fiction with John Brantingham called California Continuum, Migrations and Amalgamations. His poetry has also been published in Zocalo Public Square, Dallas Review, Poetry LA, Poetry Digest, Chiron Review. Is it Chiron or Chiron?
It's Chiron.
Okay. Poets Against the War, Review Americana, WTC Remembrances, on and on and on. His poetry has also been anthologized in such books as Orange County, A Literary Field Guide, published by Heyday, Only Light Can Do That, published by Rattling Wall, Penn Center USA, and Monster Verse, Human and Inhuman Poems, published by Knopf. He's also published short fiction and is currently poetry editor for Chiron Review. And after a decade of teaching writing right here at UC Irvine, he became a full professor at Laguna College of Art and Design, where he teaches courses in creative writing, literature, critical reasoning, and senior capstone. And you, as I said, you can read more about him on his website, which is?
GrantHeyer.com.
Okay. Hi.
Hi.
It's great to have you here in the studio. I hardly ever do this. Everybody's usually on the phone.
Yeah, I love live radio.
Yeah, I do too. Yeah. I mean, obviously, I've been here for 21 years. So first I want to start with just talking about how you became a poet. Kind of, you know, it can be a long story. Just take us into your focus, because you do all these other things, right? I mean, you do music, you do visual art, you do voice. You were on Lincoln in the Bardo, for goodness sakes, with George Saunders. George Saunders' wonderful book. So talk about how poetry became, seems to be the focus.
Yeah, it just all, it is an organic thing that grew with me as I grew. And I see it as a way of interpreting the world and just a way of being. When I'm asked, how do you find time to be a poet, or when do you find the time to turn that switch on? It's never off. It's just a way of processing the world. And so I teach at Laguna College of Art and Design, and we teach they're all visual artists, and we teach to be keen observers of the world, to notice light and shadow and to observe what's happening and how to render it and reinterpret it back. And that's something I've always done. My parents tell me I was reading at 3 years old. I had an older sister who helped.
Mm-hmm.
My grandparents were telling us stories bedtime, these fabulous stories, always reading, books always in the house, art, painting. My parents are painting and giving us little canvases to try on, piano. And so it was always this creative spirit and energy in our house and encouragement.
Hmm.
And so I was writing as long as I can remember, and just, it wasn't good, but it was figuring
writing.
Things out. Yeah, it's a way of thinking on the page. I think, was it Sontag who said, how do I know what I think until I write it,
right,
or something like that?
Right.
So it was always an enjoyable process. I mean, I was kind of a nerdy kid. I read the dictionary and loved etymologies and loved wordplay. And I wrote for 10 or 12 years without showing anybody. And I called it poetry. I realize now, looking back, it was more like me imitating song lyrics. So the first, like, we meet the Beatles. I'm dating myself here. My parents bought for my sister and me when it came out. And I started writing down all the lyrics, all the oohs and ahs and breaths, and the rhythms and the meters were mm-hmm. just, I was just fascinated with. Hmm. And so song and music, so I was writing very sing-songy, metrical, rhymey, that I called poems, but they were more like song lyrics. Mm-hmm. And it was around 1972, when I was in high school, that the first poem came that was different. And I went, whoa, what is this? And it was, I hadn't studied poetry, which was an advantage and a disadvantage, because it, those years of just tuning my ear by myself, it just became ingrained, which mm-hmm. I never would have gotten had I done another kind of study method. But by then, when I turned to the forum and started looking, I mean, I was reading Frost and Sandburg heavily, and Edna St. Vincent Millay I love. And so those poets were influencing me and getting me closer to poetry. And then I started studying it as a forum and fell in love with it and just made writing and art my life.
So in terms of, you mentioned, you know, teaching and getting your students to pay attention and observe. How important then are, when for beginning poets, are learning or starting with the form, starting with the traditional, starting with the history of poetry, starting with all those classics? Yeah. I mean, is that important at some point, at the beginning, later, at all?
I do it simultaneously. I have a book, 250 Poems. It's a good anthology for just an overview of kind of the history of poetry. That's not too expensive. So we thumb through that each session, and I tell them what's going on in the history of poetry. But then I'm giving them assignments in writing and in form. I try to tune their first to the meter and iambics and see if they have that ear. Mm-hmm. And every class is different, so it's like a diagnostic. Like, try this as a first assignment, and then mm-hmm. I'll see where the class is as a whole and see what I have to teach in terms of, you know, what level they're at. And then I break them into free verse after writing in meter, which seems very freeing to them. But then also the forms are freeing. It's a dichotomy. When you have to write to a form, it forces you out of your habits. It makes you hit those stepping stones that you mm-hmm. normally wouldn't. Mm-hmm. It makes you find that word that has a sound that you normally wouldn't go to. And so you're inventing in new places where you normally don't. We fall into habits as writers. We mm-hmm. tend to write to the end of the page mm-hmm. as poets, or we know the short story form, so we go to that form. And that's all great, and you should know the forms, but you should also know when to say, nope, to make it work, I'm going to ignore this because mm-hmm. it has to work as a poem or as a short story or whatever it is I'm writing.
So you mentioned, you know, teaching students to listen and to hear the line. And I don't know, is it like music at all, where sometimes there's someone who wants to play music, but they just have a tin ear and they just can't hear. They can't get the pitch. They just can't hear. I mean, do you find that poetry can be learned, or do you say, you know what, you'd be better as a, you know, mystery writer or a literary writer or a writer of commercials? I don't know.
Sure.
I mean,
yeah, we have our own sensibilities that, based on, you know, how we were raised or what we listened to, what we were exposed to. And some get it more easily than others, no doubt. But I think that what can be taught, a lot of writing, more writing than some have argued, can be taught. I don't think you're born a writer. I think that it's a craft, and I think it's part of the whole, what's the word? Is gestalt the right word? Mm-hmm. It's part of the whole essence of a being that includes language and music and breath and the way you listen and the way you see the world and your worldview. And how open you are to the world depending on those things will influence what comes out. So some people who have never listened to meter struggle with it, but then there are tricks you can use as a teacher or tools you can go to. You can say, well, let's then, what do you listen to?
Mm-hmm.
Song lyrics? Okay, well, mm-hmm. that's how I learned. Mm-hmm. So let's look at your songs and see how it's broken down. Mm-hmm. Let's look at this, you know, Kendrick Lamar, or let's look at this thing that isn't considered poetry, you know, traditionally, Bob Dylan, who's the Nobel laureate, he's, you know, that's a huge argument whether he's a poet or not.
What do
but
you think?
But it's, well, he's writing literature, and he won the Nobel Prize for Literature.
Right.
I always say with labels, you know, let someone else figure it out. Don't just let it be the best thing that you can do, and regardless of form, don't worry what genre it's going to be. Serve the writing. If it make it a good poem, if it's a poem, make it something in between poem, a poem and prose, if it serves that. As long as you're getting to the emotional truth, that's what I keep saying. I think Tracy K. Smith talks about emotional truth, and I do too a lot. That's the thing. Poetry frees us from the tyranny of literal meaning. Tracy K. Smith
the
says.
The tyranny of literal meaning. Have you written that down? That's a good line.
That's Tracy K. Smith's phrase.
I love that.
Yeah. So it's not the, you know, and she also says poetry is not the language of our day-to-day. Mm-hmm. It's something else, but it's not. I was talking with my wife last night about this, that she has a student who just does not get poetry. Mm-hmm. And he's really into math and calculus, and he wants the bottom line. He wants the deductive reasoning. But what does it mean? Why are you saying it that way? You know, the figurative language and the symbolism.
Right.
And the things that, you know, a poem should not mean but be, I think Archibald MacLeish said.
Well, I want to hear one of yours.
Sure.
I have Similitude in front of me. Mm-hmm. And I wanted to, well, there's a few here I want to talk about, but I wonder if you would read Across the Town on 26.
Sure. Across the town, bell splashes awake. Waves pulse the sky to vibrate all flesh near. Each leaf hung, the tone transposed, hums now within, drives both sap and blood. Traffic floods the roads before work, at noon, at 5. Cars take turns merging, regardless of each driver's religion or politics. The waitress takes home the newspaper left behind in the booth, kicks off her shoes that night, feels the toll, solves the puzzle, curls her hair. Morning doves rest like notes on the same power line the scavenger rat ran all last night. Lights change. We find a way to share this world.
I love that. I love that line, cars take turns merging regardless of each driver's religion or politics. Mm-hmm. Talk about writing this poem, where it came from.
Well, that line, actually, I got from Jon Stewart of The Daily Show. And he was talking about what he loves about America. And he was talking about the Lincoln Tunnel. Mm-hmm. And as you're going in, you're just letting we find a way. We just, regardless of the bumper stickers on the cars, we get along.
Right.
You know, we can do this. Mm-hmm. And I love that. And I agree with that sentiment. This is actually a form. This is in form. And you can see the haiku buried. It's 57577. It's a tonka. And so each stanza is a tonka. And that's what drove it. And I liked one of the things. I think if I have a signature move in my poems, I really love assonance and internal rhymes. Mm-hmm. And I love the form that is there that doesn't show itself. So some of my favorite poets, Robert Wrigley, for example, he has a poem called My Father's Fingernails that I read and I went, wow, what a great poem. And then I looked back and I went, it rhymes. Mm. Oh my gosh. Mm-hmm. I had, but you read it without realizing it.
It was
so, through enjambment and through slant rhyme and through just the breadth and meter of it, it just flowed organically. And so I love, my goal as a writer is to have a structure to it, but have it not necessarily evident. Mm-hmm. And so that the poem has this, whether you recognize it or not, there's something that's holding it together. Mm-hmm. And there's more to look for.
Okay. How about, well, before we go on, so, because we're going to talk about this and you have an example later on of revision, but like, what did this look like when you had an initial draft, and how many drafts did you put it through, and how did it change? Do you remember that?
Yeah, I do remember that. This one of the things that drove this poem was from that idea of sharing the world. I thought of a narrative where there's interconnectedness, so that the person reads the newspaper in the booth, the waitress takes it home, mm-hmm. that's carried on, how we're all connected, mm-hmm. how the line that the doves rest on, a scavenger rat ran down. That scavenger rat was an edit late, right before the book went through press, and Mark Givens of Pelicanesis, he's very generous in allowing me to have input and to make late edits. And it's a great press. All of his titles are really wonderful. I'm proud to be a part of it. But what I did was, this was part of a series of poems I wrote that started in April 2017. A poet friend of mine said, it's National Poetry Month, April. Mm-hmm. Let's write 30 poems for April. Hmm. And I went, no, I don't have the time. And as soon as that came out of my mouth, I caught myself and I'm like, come on, you're right. So four of us went, the rules were you had to email it to the other poets doing it by midnight, and you don't have to comment on it, it's just proof you did it. And so we did it, and at the end of April I said May, and two poets dropped out and two more came in, and then at the end of May I went June, and it was crickets, and they went, no, I can't. And so I went, well, I'm going to keep doing it. And then it wound up a full year. So that's going to be my next book. I wrote, over 365 days, I wrote 377 poems. And it completely changed me as a writer.
How so?
The craft of writing. Well, because I go through dozens and dozens of edits. And some poems, 100 edits. I love the long, slow lingering of language. I love living with it and breathing it and staying with it and letting it be a part of my life until it comes to a point where I see no more moves and it seems fully realized. And so poems might take months and months. And some poems I have years of editing on. I'm still working on them. I'll get back to them. It's the poems that call the loudest. I always have a lot of poems in progress. For this 365, though, I didn't have time to do that process. So, and often it was late at night. So 11:30 at night, I'm driving home from work, and I'm not going to get home. So what do? I pull the car over and write? No, I pick up my phone and I dictate a poem to my phone. So it's just off the top of my head. Or this poem, Across the Town, if you look across the page, it's Along the Wild.
Right, where there are certain themes that cross over.
It's exactly what I did. I was, after I wrote the Across the Town, I pulled up an old poem to edit from, and I went, okay, with the seed, what's an opposite of Across the Town? Or pick parallel words. Along, across, the town, the wild. Bell splashes awake, creek splashes.
Well, read that one.
Okay, so the first line, bell splashes awake, became creek splashes snake track. And so I kept it five, but I didn't keep it 575. Or did I find a way to pick
I think
this
you did.
I varied it a bit. No, I did. So I just kept looking back and using that as a seed, but trying to make it a narrative that flowed. So Along the Wild, creek splashes, snake track waves pulse the sandy banks with fresh patterns. Each note sung here, bones exposed from snow melt, the hives will hum here soon. Havoc of road kills punctuate the blacktop. Life has no rehearsal. Cats reflect the driver's, cars reflect the driver's grief, collisions versus. We wait for the one who's patient and kind, but in truth, we fight. We scoff at gentleness, seek to find hardness within, curse the weak. Worker bees protect the queen in winter, her fine piping. They cluster, flutter to keep her warm. We find a way to bear this world.
Yeah, and both poems end with world.
Both poems, right. We Find a Way to Share This World, mm-hmm. is the first. We mm-hmm. Find a Way to Bear This World. Mm-hmm.
I found that throughout this book, that on facing pages, there are a lot of the poems connected.
In that and one section, I do that.
Yeah.
It became kind of like a diptych, mm-hmm. Where they're meant to be seen together, but they should stand alone.
And I noticed when you were reading that your hand was moving as if you were keeping the beat.
Mm-hmm.
And are you doing that when you write too? Do you read aloud and just see if there's the rhythm? And if there isn't, you take away a syllable, you add a syllable, you deal with the rhythm?
Yeah, always. Rhythm is the music of it is first and foremost, mm-hmm. for me. And yeah, and so the ear is a great editor, and that's another teaching tool that I teach in all my writing classes when I'm teaching writing, is take your draft and read it aloud.
Mm-hmm.
Take your draft, read it into your phone, and then keep playing it back. Seeing what, because your ear will notice things you won't notice on the page after looking 100 times
mm-hmm.
at it.
Mm-hmm.
You'll go, oh, I said that word 3 times. I mm-hmm. didn't even realize it. Or just the way that the breath is driven. If you have to stumble, or if it seems to slow at a certain point where it shouldn't, or if you want to, if there's a word that you want to emphasize, how to emphasize it, make it the end word on the line because it hangs there and there's the white space, mm-hmm. the last word on the line has more, it stays in your head longer because your eyes have to go back mm-hmm. to the mm-hmm. next line.
Mm-hmm.
So it has a little bit more emphasis, and also it's hanging out there in the white of the page. So all these things are just things to point out to writers and say, did you notice this? Here, mm-hmm. you will start noticing it.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what we do with all art forms,
is
just become a better better craftsperson. I think it's the rigor of the work.
Mm-hmm.
Galway Kinnell has a great line. I interviewed him about one of my favorite lines. He said, laughter is our stuttering in a language we can't speak yet.
Mm.
And he was talking about, we were talking about Rilke's Angels. And he said, I don't know where the poem comes from. I don't necessarily believe in angels. But I know that if it's true and it comes from some sort of divine source, that's not enough because we have to put the human work into it.
Hmm.
It has to relate to the human. So I love the idea of that language that we're striving to get to, but we're mm-hmm. babbling.
Mm-hmm.
And that laughter is our stuttering. And so I think that's what we do when we're writing. We're kind of trying to get to that, it sounds highfalutin, but that divine, something that is more than just the words, something that takes us to a place, something that elevates, it's 1 + 1 = 3. It's something more than just the words and more than just the story.
Mm-hmm.
It evokes something else, mm-hmm. if that makes sense.
Mm-hmm. You are listening to Writers on Writing on 88.9 KUCI-FM. I'm with Grant Heyer, and we just were talking about poems in Similitude, published by Pelicanesis. So we're talking about line breaks. You mentioned enjambment. I've heard writers say, I can't write poetry because I can't hear where the line should break, or I don't understand enjambment. Can you talk about those things?
Yeah, it's enjambment is a great technique to hide the craft, I think. At least that's one of the primary ways that I use it and that I teach it. It's to, especially when you're writing in a form and you want that word to have a certain sound, you can run it straight into the next line and make it sound more like prose and make it sound less like poetry. And therefore, the sing-songy ding-dong rhymes aren't evident
mm-hmm.
by using slant rhyme or whatever. There are some poets, in my poetic sensibilities, I so held that craft element of Frost, who said writing in free verse is like writing with a net down. This in my early years, I did. I was kind of a disciple of that. So I didn't understand poets who would put a the at the end of the line.
Mm-hmm.
And then one of my favorite poets, Sharon Olds, mm-hmm. did it all the time.
Mm-hmm.
And I was lucky enough to work with her a few times. And she, I talked with her about it. And it was more of the whole it just seemed to be, her sensibility said to break it there, and it seemed right, and it certainly seemed right to me when I read it.
Mm-hmm.
But that's part of the mystery. Mm-hmm. I mean, there was no, you can't say any one thing is making it work or not. It's right. A dynamic of, well, you know, as a writer and, mm-hmm. and an editor, it's the whole thing and how it works and mm-hmm. all the components mm-hmm. and what you're trying to accomplish and what the audience is. It's all those considerations.
Right.
And the end of the line break is just one thing. And enjambment is just one thing. So you can have a beautiful poem that doesn't, you can be a great poet without knowing enjambment.
And talk about what that is for those who don't know.
Yeah, enjambment. So traditionally, especially in the history of English verse, poems were end-stopped. That is what it sounds like. There's a period or an exclamation point or a question mark or a stop at the end of each line. I shot an arrow into the air. It fell to earth, I know not where. And so rhyme, end, new line. When the line ends, the sentence ends or the thought ends with a punctuation mark. That was the traditional form. Whitman blew that wide open, and the poets at the time said, this isn't poetry. Mm-hmm. This is, you know, what is this? But he was using the long lines of the Bible and the music of, you know, it would be the breath and the music of it. And so enjambment is where you don't end stop a line, but you have that word, that phrase that you're saying, continue on the next line without pause.
Mm-hmm.
Although there is a pause as your eyes go back, as I said earlier. And so that's just one of the techniques of writing, and the modern poets did that more and more. So that right now writing in the forms is you know, there are pockets of poets who write in the form, and I write in the form sometimes, but I don't think about writing in the forms unless I'm giving my class an assignment, and I'll try it too.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm always, it doesn't mean that my poetry doesn't have form. It's form I invent according to the needs of the poem.
Mm-hmm. Interesting. And you've talked about slant rhyme a lot, and I love slant rhyme, but it's one of those esoteric terms, I think, for new poets
yeah.
or people who are just starting or trying to figure out poetry. Talk about that, what that
yeah.
is.
Yeah, slant rhyme, it's a word that doesn't rhyme exactly,
mm-hmm.
But is close in assonance or one of the things that I teach when I'm teaching, especially advanced poetry, is actually the linguistics of it, the phonology of speech, so that phonology, I should say, where how a B and a P are both bilabial plosives. One is voiced, one mm-hmm. isn't. But if you put them, you can look at the word mm-hmm. and your mouth will be doing the same thing, the mouth mm-hmm. feel. So that you can have a word that will be doing the same thing in the mouth, but either be voiced or unvoiced. You can have words that have a slightly different letter, but have the same vowel sound, but they're both somewhere close to that sound, and you go, yeah, that's a pair word. That's almost a rhyme. False rhymes. I rhymes, where the word looks the same, but it's pronounced differently. And so, you know, good and mood,
mm-hmm.
They'll both be the double OD, mm-hmm. and they'll say, oh, that's a rhyme, but no, it is to the eye.
Mm-hmm.
So that's another way that you can play with burying and hiding the form.
Mm-hmm. Love it. Okay. So what about, do you ever, well, I want to talk about persona.
Sure.
Because I mean, I love all sorts of poems, but I find it really interesting when writers or poets say, well, that was a persona. I that's not me.
Mm-hmm.
And it's like writing fiction as a fiction writer to my way of thinking, but I don't know if that's what that is.
Yeah, it is. It's the same in poetry.
I mean, because everybody thinks you write a poem and that's about you.
Almost everybody thinks that.
Yeah.
Yeah, except other writers.
Right.
Who know better.
Right.
And then there are some poems that are thinly disguised. My first book, Untended Garden, was a long poem of 98 pages, and it really was an exploration of sense of place here in Orange County and Anaheim, and my quest narrative to discover who came here before me and what life forms were here and where were the rivers that have since been rerouted? And what are these artifacts, these cogstones that we found that we don't know from a culture that was here 8,000 years ago? What are the stories beneath the feet? And so that was really me mm-hmm. on the page mm-hmm. and talking about my mother and my grandparents and the thoughts I have and my philosophy. And I didn't disguise that. I was also very careful. It took me 20 years to write and edit, but I didn't want to assume a culture or be the white savior talking about the cultures that came mm-hmm. before. So I didn't, it was me saying, what don't I know? Mm-hmm. What should I know? Rather than trying to represent something on the page. In fiction, I use persona a lot more than poetry, but there was a, I think in my 30s, I started using persona more and more, where I would take it out. It would be some of my thoughts, but it would also be the character's thoughts. Mm-hmm. And so I would write from the point of view of a female, or I'd write from the point of view of someone who was not Grant Heyer living mm-hmm. in Anaheim. And that's very freeing, too. And can take you places that you normally wouldn't go. Mm-hmm. You know, the beginning writing, generally, I would say, if I'm painting with a very broad brush, is confessional. It's finding out what we think, kind of diary writing. Mm-hmm. These are my feelings. Right. This is what it is. And then you learn the craft and the form of it. And then as you learn the craft and the form of it, you can move away from that and get into, you know, third person and get into other characters, and the persona becomes someone other than the diarist.
Mm-hmm. What about form and theme? What I'm trying to say, yes. What I'm thinking I'm saying, because I noticed some of the poems in here have look different. You know, have a similar form, but then, like on page 67, half the world is always in darkness. You have half the poem on with a flush left margin, and half the poem, the bottom half with a flush right. And that, to me, echoes the title before I even read it. But I'm, you know, is that what you're after with certain poems? Is having it having how it looks on the page reflect what it's about?
Yeah, it if it reveals itself to me that way, I'll do it. It can be kind of hokey, you know, the concrete poems where it's a poem about a swan in the shape of a swan.
Right.
that's great, but it's so easy to do now
yeah.
with typesetting
right.
that it doesn't require the craft to get it that way mm-hmm. when there was fixed space type. Back in the typesetting days. I with the title Half the World is Always in Darkness, there's a turn in the poem. That's another thing that I teach. You know, I tell my class, I'm not trying to give you my sensibilities mm-hmm. and turn you into writers who write like
Grant Heyer.
Grant Heyer. but I will tell you what works in poetry and how it works and how different poets use it, and you know, take that technique and either use it or don't, but just be aware of it. Have it as a tool in your toolbox. So that's one of the things I did with this is the poem. You want me to read it?
Yeah, read it.
Sure.
And then afterward, talk about the turn and all that.
Yeah, that's what I was, I lost my thread. Half of the world is always in darkness. Awakening, the woman finds her ear slightly suctioned to the pavement beneath her. Pain that had manifested in her dream as a hot towel being pressed to her face while she sat crying, taking a bite from a badly bruised apple. While in a hospital? She can't recall. She sits up now, rubs her cheek and ear and neck. Half of her is red. On the other side of the earth, now night, directly where her ear had been pointed while she slept, men dressed in black and white had been signing papers, raising glasses, toasting to agreements that would eventually lead to events that would cause more nightmares, that would see her and her family suffer even more. She had not heard those glasses clinking, of course. Too much world between them.
Mm. Wonderful.
Thank you. Yeah, so halfway through the poem, exactly halfway, the poem goes flush right against the right-hand margin. And because there's a turn there where I move from the individual at one place on the earth to what's happening opposite on the other side. So it just fit. And then when I did it, I looked and I went, yeah, that looks good. That fits. If it didn't, I would have moved it flush left.
Mm-hmm.
Or if it seemed too trying, too forced.
Right.
But it did work. And this poem does something that I also like in some of my favorite poets. I mean, I emulate as readers and as writers, we emulate those artists that we admire, I think. At least I do. And so one of the things I like in poetry is where it takes me to a place I never would have imagined before.
Hmm.
It you earn the trust of a reader,
mm-hmm.
and if your voice is strong enough, they're willing to go with you. And then if you take them to a place and expand their thinking about something, what is directly opposite on the other side of the earth? We've all thought that.
Mm-hmm.
But then to put it into a narrative that then has some kind of larger meaning of the individual who is in this world, and then the play of light and darkness, of course. Yeah.
And then the turn is on the other side of the earth, the turn?
So the turn. So, yeah, in Italian sonnets, that's a phrase. Shakespearean Elizabethan sonnets is three four-line stanzas and then a couplet at the end. Shakespeare wrote a lot. Wrote that in that form exclusively, 100 some sonnets. The Italian Petrarchian sonnet, named after the poet Petrarch, goes 8 and 6. That is a stanza of 8 lines and then 6 lines. And between the 8th and the 6th line stanzas is a change, a point of view. And often in Shakespearean sonnets as well, the couplet will have a turn where it will look back and reflect on what was just said. Or it'll take the context of the previous lines, especially in Petrarchian sonnets, and then comment on it or look at it a new way, so that the voice, it's suddenly like, and now. And so that's what this does. We have the narrative of the woman in her point of view on the other side of the earth splits to another turn of sorts.
Yeah, yeah. Well, in short stories, the turn usually comes very close to the end.
That's right.
You know, where it's sort of, you know, you can't really call it a climax in a short story, but there's a turn.
That's right. Yeah.
And if you don't have it, then what's the point?
Yeah. It's the same thing.
Yeah.
It's the same move, writerly move.
Okay. Well, you know, favorite poet, because you brought a poem from someone that, a poet that you love, like, admire. I wonder if you'd read that and talk about why it's a poem that you love.
Yes. Louis McNeice, The Sunlight on the Garden, it's a poem that floored me as an undergraduate English major. I remember sitting in my car with the Norton Anthology of verse, just reading and leafing through, and found this poem I'd never heard before. I'll read it and then we can talk about it.
Okay.
The Sunlight on the Garden. The sunlight on the garden hardens and grows cold. We cannot cage the minute within its nets of gold. When all is told, we cannot beg for pardon. Our freedom as freelances advances toward its end. The earth compels. Upon it sonnets and birds descend. And soon, my friend, we shall have no time for dances. The sky was good for flying, defying the church bells and every evil iron siren and what it tells. The earth compels. We are dying, Egypt, dying. And not expecting pardon, hardened in heart anew, but glad to have sat under thunder and rain with you, and grateful too for sunlight on the garden.
Talk about that. Why is that? Why do you love it?
Well, when I was reading it, I went back and reread it, and I immediately noticed that the last word of the first line, garden, rhymed with the first word of the second line, hardens. So instead of the end rhyme, there's two adjacent words, but there's a slight pause because it's the end of one line to the next one. And then he does it again, minute within it. So the last word of the third line rhymes with the first word of the fourth line. And then the whole poem begins and ends with the sunlight on the garden. So the sunlight on the garden hardens. We cannot cage the minute within its lances, advances upon its sonnets, flying, defying. And so this internal invented structure that McNeice made, it just was this nice little knot that was so musical. He wrote it, I think his wife left him for an undergraduate student, and he was in the final throes of his divorce, I found out later, much later. And so there's this sadness of looking back of this relationship, the lines are in this kind of this echoing reflection on a time together. And then also The Earth Compels, We Are Dying, Egypt Dying, is a reference to, I think, Anthony and Cleopatra. And so the fading joys, this dovetailing of lines, there's a great heart to it, I think, a great emotional truth to it. And it really is a love song, but it's bittersweet, and it's full of craft. So it's great to teach, because I just have this, we read it aloud, and then I say, what do you notice?
Right.
We did this last week in my Creative Writing Poetry class. We got to that point. And then the next week's poems, they're trying that.
Sure.
So it was really nice. Yeah.
Well, in terms of talking about poetry or critiquing poetry, and you said, you know, you teach this poem and you said, what do you notice? I mean, is that a good way to go about critiquing poetry, or is, I don't know, more personal kind of emotional responses to poems? I like it, I didn't like it, I love it, I hated it. Or is it more like, I noticed you were doing this, I know, you know, I mean, how do you talk about poetry?
Yeah, I used to, when I first started teaching, it would be opinion-based. What do you think? And it would be, I like it, I don't like it. But that's subjective, and, you know, it's, I like chocolate and you like vanilla. And
right.
Just because one writer doesn't like it doesn't mean I'm going to change it. So I use the method where we talk about what's working in the poem. And then we get to a point where we ask the author, what was it you were trying to accomplish? And then we approach it from that point of view. It's like, well, if you're trying to do that, what if you do this? So then it's more directed to what the author's intent, rather than this just turned me off and I didn't like it.
Right.
Like, that's, well, what do you do with that?
At any point, at the end of the critique, do people get to rate it? I mean, or do you just try to keep that out of the critiquing process?
Yeah, there's some brutal workshops there, and you know, each teacher has his own culture. I tend to be positive. It's like, we're all trying to make the best poem possible. Let's help each other do that.
Right.
And so nobody's, in any class I teach, I say day one, no one's going to be made to feel made fun of or you know, endangered. This is a safe environment. I liken it to there are other workshops where they're in painting studio. They put their work up on the wall, and, you know, when you try to draw a human figure, you don't get it right the first time. You kind of light sketch it, and someone points out, oh, that shadow isn't right. And so these other eyes actually help you. Or driving school. We're going to learn to drive a car. You've never driven a car. We're going to learn to write a poem and try this meter.
Right.
Not that poems need to have meter, but it's a good training wheels. And so I'm going to set up cones, and you go around them, and we're all going to knock over cones. That's part of the process. That's how you get better. So don't feel bad that you knocked over a cone. A cone. Knock over a poem. There's a title.
Well, we have just a few minutes left. It's hard to believe. And so I really want you to read Femme Fatale as Applied to Food on page 105 and talk about that. And if you just tuned in, you're listening to Writers on Writing. I'm with Grant Heyer. And if you just tuned in and you want to hear the show, go to iTunes or Stitcher or wherever you get your podcasts and subscribe to Writers on Writing. And when we podcast this show, it'll land in your podcast file and you'll be able to listen. Okay.
Femme fatale as applied to food. The fish will be most remembered as its corpse upon the plate, or recalled through the years as the Valentine's Day dinner he made, despite its entire life of swimming in the sea. The fowl gets photographed dead as well, on a skewer over fire, but suspended in the air, at least more fitting in for a bird. And it will fly once again, but as a series of zeros and ones in code when that pic gets sent from a smartphone, then uncoded and uploaded to become a post on Instagram, not as a chicken, but as shish kebab. The steer is not remembered for its dusty days on the ranch, nor the pig in the sty, nor the egg in the coop. Yet all are recalled as the breakfast special, and whatever's left over, just soup.
Talk about that. Where'd this poem come from?
I don't know.
I mean, there's humor and there's sadness and there's just a lot going on here.
Yeah. Yeah, it's one of my favorite poems, actually. And it wasn't necessarily when I wrote it. It was, but there again, it took me to places I'd never thought of. I just had the thought of, I think the opening line was, the fish will be most remembered as its corpse upon mm-hmm. the plate. And then somewhere along the way, I started thinking of how it related to femme fatale. And it's not unlike the difference between where I take ideas or concepts or words and I pair them together and kind of explore how they're similar or not similar. Mm-hmm. And how is a bird, you know, the chicken is not chicken when it's on, it is a chicken, but it's not what it's been its whole life being. So it was just a fun exploration, and then I just let it take off. You know, most of the time when I write, we've talked a lot about craft and being aware of meter and looking at rhythms and structure, but when I write, most of the time I'm not aware of that. I'm just going, and it's like any art form. If you learn to play an F chord, it's very hard the first 100 times you play it, but then pretty soon you're just doing it intuitively, or you're mixing colors in your head. You become aware of compatible colors, and you just start. That becomes part of your craft, and you're doing it on the fly, and sensing it, letting it flow, and it's very musical to me. It really is, the ear and the breath and the sound, and then also the message. You know, the intellect. For me, I love a poem that isn't just words,
right,
or just music.
Right. So I don't think we have time to do this that we talked about before we came into the studio, but on one of your poems, you showed me, you know, how you numbered syllables.
Yeah.
And maybe talk about that in terms of writing poetry and how that came to you and all that.
Yeah. Sometimes, I don't always do it, but sometimes when I'm in the editing process or in the writing process, I will look back and read what I have on the page, and I'll see if I have any pattern that has been established. For a decade or more, I noticed that I was writing with 4 stressed beats per line, and it just came out that way. My line breaks, every line would have just 4 stressed beats, accentual syllabic tetrameter or whatever it would be called. But it doesn't matter what it's called. It's just that was what was happening in my internal rhythm for that decade of my life. But then I'll look and I'll count the syllables, or I'll see where the stresses are, and I'll see if there's a pattern. And if there is, it's a clue to me what the poem is trying to be and is naturally becoming, that I then turn to and let it take that. And if I follow that pattern, I'll see if it takes off or not. If it's forced, I won't do it. But it's another way to let the poem find an organic center.
Mm-hmm.
That makes sense?
Mm-hmm. It makes sense. It's really interesting to see it on the page. And this is radio, so
yeah.
We can't do that.
We can't.
But it's another way to think about it. Think about writing, or maybe after you write the poem, after you've revised at some point, to then count syllables and see if there's a pattern, or that's how right. to make it more, how to make a pattern.
That's right. Yeah. I mean, or look at a poem and count the lines. Mm-hmm. You might have 10 lines, 11 lines, 9 lines, 10 lines, 10 lines, and you go, oh, if I just make the 11 a 10 and mm-hmm. a 9 a 10 and move that, I have 10-line stanzas. Mm-hmm. What would that look like?
Right.
And then try it. I tell my students, try it.
Right.
Save your drafts. Put a date on it. Yeah, yeah. You can always go back. Don't write over them. But don't be afraid. Give it a go.
Mm-hmm. Putting together a book of poems. Now, I don't know if it varied with, you know, these various collections, but how do you do that? I mean, are you looking at it as... I don't know, a narrative of its own, or, I mean, how did you arrange poems, say, in Similitude?
Yeah, that was a process that I just lived with it, and it revealed itself to me. I kind of sorted the poems out in different ways. I laid them all out on a table.
Mm-hmm.
And you know the manuscript of putting them on walls or mm-hmm. sitting on the floor. Mm-hmm. So I kind of saw poems that went together or were grouped together, and then I looked, well, why are they together? And then saw what pattern emerged, and what became apparent in Similitude is it was like cell replication. So so I named the sections of what was happening on a cellular level. I love science, and there's a lot of science in my poems. So single cells are four opening poems that look very, very simple, but there's a complex structure to them.
Mm-hmm.
The poem Naturally is one of those that Chris Davidson, a wonderful poet, invented. And he does, it's beats per line and mostly iambic, but with a anapest in there. And it was just an exercise that you wouldn't notice necessarily on the page. And then I tried to hide it.
Mm-hmm.
So little simple single cells to the splitting off of things to the what they call the sister cell, where the cell runs to the opposite sides, and then I have a whole section in a voice of or about women, just because of the sister cell they call it. So that kind of fit,
mm-hmm.
and that was that form. The difference between was a series of poems that I wrote with the anaphora of the difference between, and they just kind of all came together. So I live with it, and I see what kind of forms they take, and I do like it to have a narrative. I'm of the old school where a record album has a story,
right?
And you put it on and right. you flip it over. But that's totally irrelevant now to the way that music is listened to.
Mm-hmm.
But if it's there, you can put it that way, and if people want to listen to it, it's there.
Mm-hmm.
If not, each poem should, each story should in
right.
a book
right.
stand on its own.
Right.
And then, but if you have a larger arc that's happening, all the better.
Hmm. I'm so sad we're at the end of our time. There's so much more to talk about.
What a joy speaking with you. It flew by.
Maybe just last words, advice for the poets/writers listening.
Fear not. Give it a try. It's a wonderful exercise. And you don't have to show anybody. If you don't want to, but poetry can give you it gave me all kinds of things, and it's just a wonderful thing to try. So give it yeah. a try, all the arts.
And I say over and over, no matter who's on the show, I say that whatever you're writing, you should be reading poetry.
Oh, yeah.
Even if you have no intention of ever writing it, just to get that infusion of language and I don't know. Poetry's precious.
You won't get an argument from me.
Grant Heyer, thank you very much.
Oh, thank you so much.
And thank all of you out there for listening. We will be back next week. You've been listening to Writers on Writing. Thank you, and remember to get some writing done today.